BBC Five Live.
Good morning, Fevzi. How are you doing?
Morning. Good, thank you.
Good. Thanks very much for joining us. Fevzi, of course, at Gadget Detective. You can contact him anytime on there through the week. But you've got exclusive access to him right now for the next 90 minutes. So give us a ring on 08085 909 693. And Fevzi, it's the last tech phone-in before Christmas, of course. What a year it's been, really, for technology and gadgets and the like. So I think we'll start then by running through some of your favourites, if that's okay. And I'm quite intrigued by the first one that you've put on your list, which is the Nest Cam IQ indoor camera. What is it, first of
all? So this is part of this category of gadgets which has been very big this year and will be bigger next year, the Internet of Things devices. So devices that we may have had in the past but now attached to the internet and by virtue of that connection have some sort of intelligent functionality. So this is from a company called Nest. Nest, now owned by Google. This is their new high-end indoor camera, and it's called Nest Cam IQ, and it's called IQ because it's got a couple of good tricks up its sleeve. Essentially, it's a very good indoor security camera, and when I say a very good indoor one, it's got a very clever trick. So the sensor in it is a 4K sensor. That's to say it's got four times as many dots on it as a normal full HD sensor. Oh. And so a lot of cameras that you buy nowadays, they're not even full HD. There's what are called 720p, which is a lower resolution. This one's 4K, but what it does is it records in full HD, not 4K, but it uses those extra pixels to be able to pan, scan, and zoom without actually having to physically move the head. So when it detects a human being, for example, and it knows the difference between, let's say, the dog and a human, it zooms in on the area of interest. It automatically sort of does this sort of swoop down video-wise onto what it is. Oh. And it sends you an alert when it detects movement. But not only can it tell the difference between, you know, a spider crawling across it and or a dog running across the room and a human, it can tell you which human.
It can tell you which person it's seeing.
Yeah, because it's internet connected and it does some very sort of clever processing and it does face recognition.
So do you have to tell it? Do you have to kind of program it and say, I want you to recognise this face as Callum, this face as Fevzi? Is that how that works?
Yeah, well, yeah. So it will identify individuals and then you can name them essentially and it will then tell you who that person is. And the benefit of that, of course, is that it will know the difference between, you know, a member of your family walking through past the camera and someone who shouldn't be there, be it overnight or even during the daytime as well. So very clever. The other thing is it allows two-way communication. So you can speak through the speaker to whoever's in the room and they can speak back to you. Now, why would you want that? Well,
so you can pretend to be on Big Brother.
It's not just that. Well, you can, first of all, you can scare the hell out of a burglar and the speaker on this is much better than you would find on any similar devices. It's kind of quite a booming speaker. But it's also good for example, if you've got an elderly member of the family, maybe who lives on their own or is a full risk, you know, they tend to get up and wander. This will tell you when they're on the move. It'll tell you it's them. And it will allow you to speak to that person and them to speak back to you as well. So it's got that sort of functionality to it as well. So, it's, you know, you could use it as a baby monitor. You could use it as an elder's monitor, and particularly good, as I say, because it's got the movement sensor built in. And just very good quality picture, very good quality sound. Not cheap. The list price on this is £299. Although I note at the moment they're giving away a Google Home Mini, which is one of these smart speaker boxes as well. So I've given it 4 stars out of 5. Would have been 4.5 if it were a little bit cheaper. But shop around for that because there are often deals to be had. The other one from Nest as well is called the Nest Cam Outdoor. This one's slightly less smart, but is cheaper. So this one's about £179, again with that free Google smart speaker at the moment as well. This one's a waterproof speaker. It's designed to be mounted outdoors. It doesn't have the face recognition, but it does have the movement sensors, and so it will alert you to a move. You can use your smartphone, like with the IQ, you can use a smartphone to look at what the camera is seeing, and you get alerts with pictures and all the rest of it. But that one's cheaper, and it's again, it's a full HD camera, but it doesn't have, because it hasn't got the bigger sensor. It doesn't have that additional capability of being able to zoom in. But if cost is a consideration, that is still a very good camera. And again, 4 stars out of 5. So,
nice.
I kind of like that. There are loads of these cameras on the market,
yeah.
A lot of them from kind of small companies that we've never heard of and technically good, but not necessarily a brand name that we associate with. This is well built. It's a brand that, you know, many of us will know, and as I say, the build quality is there as well. So 4 stars out of 5 for both of those cameras.
Brill, good reviews. And I'm intrigued to come back to kind of automated homes and things around the house a little bit later on, but we'll go to a couple of callers first of all. Reminder, 0808 590 9693 to get through to Fevzy, the gadget detective, or text us on 85058. Let's start with Jack in Sussex. Good morning, Jack.
Hi there. Hi. How are you guys? Yeah, happy Christmas to you guys.
Oh,
yeah.
Thanks
you too,
very
Jack.
Much, Jack.
Yeah.
And to you.
Yeah.
Right, what can Fevzy help you with then, Jack?
I'm having problems with my mobile phone. I think the phone's got its own problems that I probably really need to replace the phone. But I'm also wondering, whether I need to replace the SIM card, you know, whether, because on another mobile phone, when I had a problem there, the SIM card stopped working, I got a replacement there. And I'm wondering whether with this is my main phone that I've had for years.
What kind of phone is it, Jack?
Pardon?
Do you know what kind of phone it is?
It's the Samsung Galaxy Ace. It's probably about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old, I think.
Okay.
But I'm just also wondering about the SIM card, really, whether I should get a replacement SIM card from the phone company. But I wanted to ask Fevzy, if I got a replacement SIM card, what information do I need to make sure I've got copies off the phone or the SIM card, so that, you know, and I've got, it backed up or whatever.
Sure, no, I understand. Jack, most of your data will not be stored on the SIM card. There is some basic storage available on SIMs, but for example, your contact details and everything, all the details of your contacts, will tend not to be stored on the SIM card and will be stored on the main device. So swapping out the SIM wouldn't really affect that. I mean, different phones store either nothing or minimal amounts on the SIM card, so it's not too much of a worry. Even the text messages, emails, all of that should really be on the main phone. One of the reasons why not much gets stored on SIM cards anymore is partly because the capacity is limited, but it's also the length of the information. So, you know, the length of each field of data, so the field for name, address, and so forth, it would often get truncated. So I wouldn't worry too much. I mean, perhaps worth looking at your settings to see if it's writing anything to there. So, but sometimes you get a choice of where you write it. But my money would be on, you probably wouldn't lose anything or anything significant.
Do you get dodgy SIM cards where that starts to cause problems with making calls and sending tech, that sort of thing? Is that something that happens, or is that normally the phone itself?
Well, so the SIM card, it's funny because people think you can't make a phone call without a SIM card. The SIM card is the way in which the mobile phone operator can identify you and therefore bill you for the calls. And that's why, for example, if you take the SIM card out, you can still make a 999 call, because that's a requirement that phones should not be disabled because there's no billing. The 999 call is still makeable. So but it is possible for SIM cards to cause a problem, because if the SIM card is damaged in some way, that can affect the ability to make calls, because the network doesn't like it. It thinks there's something wrong and might not allow calls to be made. Having said that, I mean, this is a low risk thing, because it's free of charge to swap over. Mostly what it is inconvenience. There might even be a piece of downtime where one SIM card is disabled and the other one isn't quite fully active yet. SIM cards, sometimes they take a while to fully register, you know, they'll come on in pieces, as it were, in terms of their functionality. So, but I wouldn't worry too much about it. You, by all means, do a backup, but the backup will tend to back up the internal memory anyway. Most, if you have any chance of backing up the SIM card, it would be using the Samsung's own apps. But even then, I think it probably wouldn't do it. So I would do a backup anyway, because you know, a backup is always a good thing. But that's not really going to protect you when it comes to swapping the SIM card. But I don't think you'll lose anything. I'd go ahead and ask for it. You didn't mention clearly what the problem was and why you thought it might be related to the SIM card.
Well, it's just recently it's just having problems connecting to the network, making calls, sending text messages. I mean, in the last year or two, my sort of connecting to the network is I've got just having general problems. I didn't used to have that such a problem, and I'm just wondering whether today basically what happened was when I powered up the phone, it came up with an error message. There was some sort of, I can't remember what it said. It said SIM card crash or something. Contact your service provider or something. So, you know, I don't know if that was a random error or something, but
good enough. Look, I think it's worth swapping out. I mean, if you wanted to do some experiments with it yourself, you'd take out the SIM card and pop it into another phone, see if it replicates the problems. Put a different SIM card into that phone. Doesn't have to be the same phone number. See if the problems go away. You know, that sort of thing. Keep an eye on, you know, when you are having problems, is it because it's showing no bars of signal, for example, or are you showing full signal on the problem? So you could do all that, and they'll probably talk you through some of that when you speak to them. Or you could just go ahead and order a replacement SIM. Which network are you on, by the way?
It's T-Mobile.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, they're pretty good at that sort of thing. So they should change that for you without too much of a query. If they start running you through hoops, just go online and order it.
Fevzi Turkalp's with us. I'm going to go straight to Kerry in Oxford, who's given us a call. Another mobile phone-related question. Hello, Kerry.
Hello there. Good morning.
Hiya. What do you need a bit of help with from Fevzi?
It's in relation to Samsung S8 smartphone that I've had it for a couple of months, and I'm just getting used to it and setting it all up. But I always thought when I got a smartphone, Fevzi, that I would put some sort of antivirus software on it. I've always had Norton in the past when I've been using my desktop. But I found out recently that there's already some sort of antivirus software on there with McAfee that is already installed on top of something called Samsung Knox. And my phone is prompting me to activate that, actually. So I've been sort of trying to find out what the best way to go, whether to activate it or not, because I believe there's some sort of debate as to whether it's necessary or not, but I would feel more comfortable with it. But also, the next question really is, do you think it's best to activate the software that's already on there, or perhaps put on, say, Norton, if I prefer that? But will that conflict with the software that's already on there, even if it's not activated?
Yeah, I understand.
Is it best to kind of keep it simple and go with what's on there, or not activate it, but install a software that I'm perhaps more familiar with?
Yeah, I understand. These are good questions, Kerry. So I guess the preamble to this question is I now think of phones as being what they are, which is mobile computers, which happen to make phone calls as well. And although Android operating system, such as the one that you have, is less prone to viruses, or there are fewer viruses out there for Android than, say, compared to Windows. However, the risk does still exist. Any sort of security software that you use, be it from McAfee or Norton or anything, will not protect you against all the threats, because there are many attack vectors to a mobile phone, because there are app stores, and particularly with Google's Play Store, it is significantly more vulnerable to malware, some sort of bad program, being in the legitimate app store than, say, Apple's iOS. And that's, even Apple's iOS is not 100%. And part of the reason for that is because there's quite a big difference in the vetting processes between what Google does when it allows an app into its store and what Apple does. Apple is more stringent in advance. Things have still snuck by Apple. So even with you know, antivirus and security software, it's not going to pick up everything. But what you want is security software that will, even if it doesn't know about a particular app, it will use what are called heuristics. So it will look for suspicious behavior. So even if it doesn't know about a specific virus or a specific bad app, it will look for specific behavior. Now, McAfee, look, this is a matter of opinion, and I will just give you my opinion for what it's worth. I believe that there's a good reason why McAfee is included on all sorts of hardware, is because McAfee are finding it hard to sell their stuff. It's a personal opinion, but my preference would be either for to go for something like Norton, and with the Norton stuff from Symantec, the very many of the products you get now will have either 5 or 10 activations on them, so you can get one license and cover, say, a Windows PC, an Apple Mac, an iOS device. That's my device waking up. I don't know what it thought I said then. Sorry, that was my iPad waking up. It will allow you to cover, you know, your various mobile devices and so forth. And to give you an example, you can buy the Norton protection, say, for 10 machines. You can usually get that for about £20.
Right.
And they all run concurrently. You can't sort of run it one after the other and have many years of use. Having given you the long answer, I'll now give you the short answer. I wouldn't activate the McAfee. I would use something like Norton or perhaps a third-party product. There are some as well. Also, bear in mind that some security software has additional security features that aren't just about protecting you from malware. For example, some of them have got good software to allow you to sort of find your phone if it's stolen, to trace it, to get the camera to snap the miscreant who stole it, that sort of thing. There are applications out there that do that as well. But I personally wouldn't, if it was my machine, I wouldn't be activating the McAfee, no.
There you go, Kerry. Right. Hope that helps.
That has certainly
good.
Helped, yes.
Great.
Thank you.
Not at all. Thanks very much.
Thanks very
for
much.
Calling
Cheers,
in.
Kerry.
Nice to speak to you, Kerry. Febs, we've had a couple of text messages in, so let me just put some of these to you. The first one from Ewan in Glasgow, who says, looking at the fruit-based... I think we can say Apple, can't we?
We can say Apple. Yeah.
looking at Apple's offering in laptops, and a bit confused. I work in architecture and use a lot of graphic and computer-aided design software, so require a powerful machine, but don't know which one to go for. When I spec them all up, there ends up being £1,000 difference between them, and I'm not sure why. It's intriguing, actually, when you kind of compare similar models from the same kind of manufacturer, and actually little tweaks here and there add up to huge amounts of money.
Yeah. Apple's offering used to be very simple under Steve Jobs. I'm not saying, oh, you know, Steve Jobs and all this, but
lost their
it
way
used to
since
be.
Steve Jobs went.
Well, you know, when Steve Jobs, after having been sacked from Apple, came back, one of the things that he did, because Apple was on its knees, it was on the brink of going bust, and one of the things that he did, in my opinion, quite wisely, was he rationalized the product offering. He killed off whole swathes of products, and for the products that were available, they just picked the configurations that they thought were best. So it was the Apple knows best idea, and people started to criticize that and say they wanted choices, they wanted it more like Dell was at the time, where you could pick the graphics coprocessor and the amount of RAM and the hard disks and everything. Nowadays, Apple's laptop offering and other offerings have become more complicated, hence this question. So there are different types of laptop that Apple offer. They all come under the name MacBook, but there are different types. So the one that's just called the MacBook is a 12-inch, very lightweight, very small
12-inch device. 12-inch
screen. Yeah, exactly, on the diagonal 12-inch screen. And it's actually lighter than the larger iPad Pro with a keyboard attached. If you attach a keyboard to an iPad Pro, it actually weighs more than the MacBook, the 12-inch MacBook. So that device, it uses a very low-power processor. It's a fanless design, which means that it's completely silent. So, for example, you know, if I wanted one to use in front of a microphone, I could consider that, except the keyboard is a bit clicky. But in terms of fans, you won't have fans whirring up. But because it's a fanless design and it uses this low power processor, it's okay for word processing and spreadsheets and so forth, but it's not good for anything that's graphically intensive, all right, because the processor itself is not powerful and it doesn't have a separate or discrete graphics coprocessor. Yeah, so all the processing done by the main processor. So that, unless you're after the sort of the most lightweight and svelte solution, that the MacBook is not for you. Then there are MacBook Pros, okay, and the MacBook Pros have been criticized for the latest generation because they've done away with a lot of the pro features. They're kind of like MacBook rich consumer now rather than pro. A lot of the ports, you know, the connectors that were on the previous generation have disappeared, and now there are 1, 2, or 4 USB-C connectors on MacBooks. Now, so the MacBook Pros come in a 13-inch screen size and a 15-inch screen size, and various, you know, specs within that. The difference that I think will be important to Ewan is that the 15-inch screen size come with graphics coprocessor built into them. So that's to say you've got not only a powerful processor, and you can get true quad-core processors in the 15-inch, whereas on the 13-inch MacBook Pros, they're dual-core. So first of all, the 15-inch will allow you to have a more powerful processor. Secondly, it will have a graphics coprocessor in it, and that's very important because a lot of programs, even ones that aren't graphical, use the graphics engine to do processing. In fact, if you look at a lot of supercomputers now, they use graphics cards, rows and rows of graphics cards to be really, because it's a very powerful way of doing processing these days. So if graphics are important to you, if power is important to you, then the 15-inch MacBook Pro, and that's the reason why they're a lot more expensive than the 13-inch or the 12-inch MacBook, because the processors are meatier and they have the graphics chip inside it as well. Plus, of course, you've got a bigger and higher resolution screen as well, and that might be important to you. Obviously, with the 15-inch, it's not as light, and you lose some of the portability of the 13-inch and 12-inch models. But if the power is more important, then that will do. You know, that will be a true desktop replacement. Apple, by the way, used to do a 17-inch with it, which they no longer do. I don't know if you remember that, but the 15-inch MacBook Pro. There are alternatives, by the way, if you don't want to have a Mac. Obviously, there are, you know, Dell XPS 15, for example, is a very good Windows equivalent of that, you know, and actually can be a bit more powerful as well. Okay. The RAM capacity and speed in the MacBook Pros is not state of the art. It's good enough. You know, you probably wouldn't notice it until you read the specs, but it's interesting that... you know, in a lot of areas, Apple are advanced in some ways, but in terms of hardware, sometimes are playing catch-up. And that's true of the iPhone X, for example, that a lot of the features and technologies that are new to Apple with the iPhone X have been in the Samsung flagship models for at least a year. Things like edge-to-edge display, for example.
Yeah. If I may, I'm just going to sneak in a question here from Nikki, who's our studio manager this morning, who has got a bit of a challenge for you, Fevzi. So if something springs to mind straight away, Brill. Otherwise, of course, you're here till 3:30, so we can pick up if you need a bit of time.
Sure.
So her boyfriend, bit of a tech guru, loves his gadgets, looking for a Christmas present, obviously, that time of year, but doesn't want Nikki to spend more than £15 on him. So we're looking for a £15 gadget that he's going to love.
Right, okay.
So do you want a bit of time on that one?
Well, I mean, one thing springs to mind straight away. If he's already got a lot of gadgets, that's a lot of charging that needs to be done. So, and that's a pain if you run out of charge. So I would say one of these handheld charger units, some of them are quite clever. There are some from a company called Anker, spelled A-N-K-E-R. They're good because they're not the most expensive chargers available, like if you go for the manufacturer's branded ones, but they're not the cheapo ones that you need to worry about sort of catching fire either. So
it's good not to have to worry
about
that.
You know, because people often ask that, how do I know? You know, two bits of advice: go for a brand you know, and go for a retailer that you can trust. Do not go for, you know, well-known auction websites and things like that. Go for for a tried and trusted retailer. Now, and the reason I mentioned them is one is price, two is build quality, and three is they're quite good on keeping up with the latest technologies like rapid charging and so forth. And, so that's quite good. There's a gadget I saw the other day, and it exists, if you look on Amazon, it exists. It's one of these gadgets this Chinese gadget that's sort of branded with many different brands of the version of the same thing. It is a charger that's about the size of a small bar of soap. Again, it's, you charge it up, then you can charge your smartphone or tablet or both. But it's also doubles as a hand warmer.
Oh, wow.
So you push, it's got three heat settings and the two metal faces heat up. And it hasn't burst into flames on me yet.
I was going to say, is there any concern that a battery thing is also being used to heat you up?
To be honest, I've got one of these, and I'm a bit cautious. When I get a new gadget, I don't charge it overnight, for example. Right. I wait a bit to make sure it doesn't burst into flames in front of me. So, but I was really surprised at how effective this thing is, and at the hot top setting, it gets too hot to hold without a pair of gloves on. So it's very, very effective. Wow. And really nice this time of year.
Yeah.
And still, it's got, for those that know about this sort of thing, 5,200 milliamp hours, which means it will heat up your hands for a few hours and charge up your phone from dead and still have a bit to spare. So I kind of like those. There's ones with built-in torches as well, but that's kind of a waste of time because you're carrying a smartphone, no need for that. But I really like the hand charger one.
Yeah, that's
and
cool.
It was the one I saw was designed nice. It was about just under £20, and if you look it up online, just look up hand warmers on. Mm-hmm. On the online, you'll see a whole bunch of them. So something like that. Other thing is
she's nodding.
Yep. So and that one's a little bit over the 15, but if you go for one of the ones that isn't a hand warmer, you can come in under. And the other thing is charging up the devices at home. You don't want to have, if you've got a lot of gadgets, you don't want to have one plug per device with a lead coming in, a whole bank of plugs having to be plugged in on expander. And Anker do a device, I use one of these, it's got 10 sockets on it, 10 USB charging sockets, and it goes into one plug into the wall. It's not much bigger than a deck of playing cards, to give you an idea of the size. And along one of the long edges, there's a 10 version, I think there's a 6 version as well. And it's really very good because all the USB leads just come into that, only one thing into the wall, and it's very easy. You just put labels on it, and it's good quality, and it's got its own on-off switch, and I've used my one for over a year. It hasn't broken yet, and it's seen a fair bit of use. So something like that might be good as well.
Perfect. Nikki is thrilled. Thank you very much, Fevzy. Okay. I was going to say, actually, we had a hilarious, me and several friends were on our, we're trying to get to Orkney last weekend in the middle of the worst storm ever, but whatever. Anyway, as part of our road trip, we all had to sort of huddle round my battery portable charger thing, and we were all rationing the power from it to try and charge our phones because we were driving up these snowy roads taking forever. And I mean, it was great. It lasted so long.
Yeah.
We had three people in the car, and we managed to sort of keep our phones going all the way up the road. It was great. So yes, they're a very good thing to get.
Yeah, and you can get very helpful. So a small device might have, as I say, about 5,000 milliamp hours, but there are, in the Anker range, but other ranges as well, there are 20,000, 28,000. These things start to become slabs at that point, kind of not much smaller than a paperback book sort of thing at that point. But the reason why that's really good is you get a number of sockets on it, so you can charge two, three, four devices concurrently. The other thing is that some of the new laptops are chargeable from these devices as well. Some of them allow you to charge them through their USB-C connectors. In fact, they use those connectors as the power input, as does, say, the 12-inch MacBook we were talking about before. So again, and that's really good because that can, you've got a decent-sized battery add-on to that. It doesn't cost you a fortune because it's not proprietary. You can go out and just get it from one of these third-party companies, and then you can keep a laptop, a tablet, and a smartphone charged up for days at a time, and that's a sort of paradigm shift because it makes you a lot freer, and you don't have to push and shove when it comes to Starbucks or whatever and get near the plugs.
Let's go to James in London, who's given us a call. Good morning, James.
Morning, Callum. Good morning, Febsy.
Morning,
right,
James.
Go for it, James. What's the problem?
Febsy, I wonder if you can help us. It's to do with a PVR. It's an EchoStar Freesat 600 RS.
Right.
Do you know the one?
Well, I'm familiar with the range, not that particular model, but
no, okay.
Go ahead.
Well, it has been very good, but lately it just won't update, like new channels, etc., and it's not supported anymore by EchoStar. I think EchoStar's gone out of business, I think.
I must admit, I haven't seen anything from them for a very long time.
That's true.
But, I mean, their stuff is still on sale, but I don't know. What was the model number again?
600 RS.
Okay, so that's about 6 years old, that
it
model.
Is. It's maybe a bit more than that.
Yeah, okay. All right.
But it's been great. You know, it was in its time recommended by Which, etc., and I bought it and it did very well, but now it just won't update, new channels, etc. I'm just wondering if you had any ideas what I could do.
So, normally it takes the updates how? Does it take them?
Over satellite.
So it will take it from the Freesat feed itself.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. It could be that there's the device is no longer supported and the updates
it's no longer supported.
And then the updates are no longer being either not being provided or not being provided in a compatible form.
Right.
So I think this will take a bit more research. What I suggest, James, is if you've got are you a user of Twitter?
No.
Okay. I will take an email address from you if you're happy to give one to the producer here, and I will have a look, because that's a very specific question. But my guess is that, you know, the machine hasn't broken. My guess is that the service isn't being provided anymore.
That's exactly what I think. Yes.
Yeah, I think that's the most likely, given the age of the machine, the dearth of EchoStars on the market that I can tell. That would be my best guess. So let me have a look at that. And I will come back to you via email.
That's good of you. Thanks very much.
Cheers, James.
Thanks,
it's
James.
It's been great, but, you know, it's just a shame it's not updating.
Yeah. And unfortunately, these days, sort of, when you've got a bit of tech, and I hate to say this because, you know, I believe that, you know, we should be able to use our tech for many, many years. But unfortunately, with this sort of gadget that relies on a sort of infrastructure, you know, updates and so forth, you know, 6+ years is actually not bad. I noticed that you know, some manufacturers are end of lifing their, I mean, Apple did it with their 2011 Mac Mini. They've said it's now obsolete, and they won't be supporting it. They won't be doing repairs even that you're willing to pay for. You know, so unfortunately, that's a trend that even when machines work, They find ways to obsolete them.
They just move on. Yeah, exactly. James, thank you so much. Thanks for ringing. It's interesting, actually, the idea of a personal video recorder nowadays, I suppose, when everything's so available on demand and, you know, I can't remember the last time I recorded anything, to be honest.
Well, it's quite interesting because you've got the Freeview has advanced in such a way now where it combines, you know, the electronic program guide with on demand, mm-hmm. So you can look in the guide and a program that's gone, you can say just record it even though it's gone, and then it sort of seamlessly flips to the on demand functionality as well, which is very nice. So the newer Freesat models have that facility as well. You know, but there's a lot to be said for PVR. I mean, I noticed that James was talking about a Freesat unit, so that's like Freeview, but it uses a satellite dish as a source of the pictures rather than a normal aerial, which Freeview uses. And you know, there is still a good role for that, because there are areas of the country where, you know, Freeview signals can be poor, and Freesat is a very good way of getting subscription-free TV shows and quite a lot of them. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. There's some good products out there with good built-in recording capabilities, and there is a lot, because when you go for you know, proprietary solutions, like you get a Skybox, they're very good, they're very nice user experience, but it, you know, you switch off the subscription and the machine is effectively dead. I mean, I saw one recently where a user had recorded hours and hours of their favourite programmes onto the Skybox whilst they had a subscription, stored on the local hard drive, the hard drive built into the machine. When they stopped the subscription, not only could they not watch those channels or record from those channels, but the recordings that they made were disabled. They were physically there, but they won't let you view the recordings that you made because it's proprietary, stored in their own format. They are the kings of that castle. They actually can stop you watching the stuff that you recorded when you did have a subscription. Mm. That sort of thing I'm not a great fan of. And, you know, when you've got a Freeview box or a FreeSat box, which is sort of subscription free, it does come with some advantages as well.
Yeah. Right, let's do a couple of texts then, Fevzy. And this one has caught my attention from Shelley. Hi, I've just bought Philips Hue for the whole house.
Oh, yeah.
But due to price, I've only bought the colour bulbs for three rooms. All other rooms and bulbs are white ambience bulbs. My problem is I only seem to be able to control the colour bulbs from the app. I have to use a separate app for the white bulbs. Am I missing something? Is something going wrong? And then we'll go on. I think the second part of her text is about other sort of smart and automated systems that she might be able to use in her house, a couple of which we mentioned right at the start of the tech phone-in, of course. But let's talk about Philips Hue, first of all, which is a sort of range of light bulbs that are basically controlled from through the Wi-Fi network, your Wi-Fi network, from your phone, from your tablet, etc. And this is how you turn on and off your lights.
Yeah. And also, by the way, if you have the little adapter box or the right Amazon Alexa unit, you can do it by voice. And that's great.
And being through able to Siri, I think, on iOS as well.
Yeah, and being able to do, yeah, absolutely. And being able to do that by voice, I think, is particularly special, although gimmicky. But it is nice. So these are Internet of Things devices, as we alluded to before. So in the past, we've had light bulbs, but we never had them connected to the Internet. So with that, with the color bulbs, you can pick from thousands of shades of, you know, various colors. So you can have it match your mood. You can have the lights track the beat of the music that you're playing and have the whole room pulsing. Your neighbors will love you. They'll have noise and visual disturbances. And you can, for example, program them to come on very gradually when you wake up and mimic, sunlight, for example. So you can start to even use them as, bulbs to help you with things like seasonal affective disorder, although they don't market it for that purpose. In terms of controlling it, you should be able to control all of it through the app, and I'm not quite sure why you wouldn't be able to do that, because the more difficult thing is to control is the color bulbs, because you've got the forgive the pun, but you've got the hue that you can control, the luminosity and the color. With the other bulbs, it can either be on, off, or dimmed. I would persevere with that.
One thing, I'm quite familiar with the Philips Hue range. I moved recently and indulged a little bit in being a bit ridiculous and buying lots of these cool things. And I wonder if there's a problem. So you get the Hue Bridge, which plugs into your router. And that's kind of the hub, if you like, for all these light bulbs to connect then to the internet.
Yeah.
And one bulb I got before I actually had the broadband put in the new flat that I've just moved to. And I was still able to work it. As it was in a lamp, as a light bulb, but obviously I couldn't control it through the app because I didn't have the broadband, so I didn't have the hub connected to a router.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if there's something for Shelley gone wrong between the connection between the bulb and the Philips hub that plugs into her router, and that could be why they're not showing up in the app.
It's certainly possible. On that point, by the way, I noticed yesterday that the bridge that they sell that normally goes for about £50 is currently selling at large, well-known online retailers for £25. Bargain there. But yeah, it can be the bridge,
it's a difficult one, isn't it?
It's hard to diagnose by phone, but yes, it certainly could be the bridge.
And it's as I was saying at the start of the the start of the section where we're going to return a little bit to automation and the Internet of Things. And actually, Shelley asks then later on in her text, "I want to go fully smart in the house." I think we all want to be fully smart. But what other options are there? I'm thinking heating primarily and power sockets for power saving. Both things quite intriguing, actually, Fevzy. Talk us through what other things we could actually use in our homes to kind of automate stuff.
So you can have Internet of Things, internet-connected thermostats, where you can control the heating through an app. You can also control the thermostatic valves on the radiators through an app if you get the right sort of valve. So, you know, instead of having to bend down around the back of the sofa and turn the dial on the thermostat, which is built into the individual radiator, you can do that via an app. You can have switches that you can control, and therefore main switches, so anything that's plugged into that device can be switched on and off remotely. With the thermostat, you've got things like Nest, you've got Hive, which is marketed by British Gas. They have some nice facilities. For example, the Hive unit has a facility where it is a gimmick, frankly, but when you are approaching home and it knows you're quite close, it can be set up to turn the heating on without That's you brilliant. Actually doing anything. Although I'm not sure if it knows what direction you're heading in. You're just sweeping by your house. Does it necessarily want you? Yeah. Also, there have been cases of those devices being hacked and people's whereabouts and proximity to their home being made clear to a third party, and that's not good. So we've talked about thermostats, we've talked about light switches and light bulbs. There are also internet connected locks. You can actually put locks that can be opened remotely, and I know Amazon, for example, is trialing a technology where you'll be able to let the delivery driver in to drop the package inside the door.
It's quite a scary thought of that, isn't it, really?
Well, yes, and also because there was actually a bug found in Apple's HomeKit when it came to lock, that they've sort of disabled some of the features to stop the bug from taking effect. But in effect, it was possible for third parties to unlock your doors. So one of the things I'd say about Internet of Things is it's clearly the future, but we're quite early in the story of it. And one of the weaknesses that many of these newly internet connected devices have is security. So light bulb manufacturers and lock manufacturers and thermostat manufacturers are used to making those devices. They're not used to doing internet security, which is a complex field. You know, people who manufacture computers have been used to dealing with this problem for a long time. And therefore, these Internet of Things devices are often the weak points of security, and you need to bear that in mind, both in terms of your locks popping open, but also being able to access the computer or something on the same network. Mm. So you should consider putting them on a separate network as well if you're going to have them, and don't rely on them completely, not yet.
And let's go straight to the phones and speak to Paul in Liverpool. Hello, Paul.
Yeah, hi you guys, how are you?
Yeah, good, morning, thank Paul. You, Paul. What can Febsy help with?
Yeah, I'm thinking about getting my little lad who's six, Anki Overdrive and Anki Cosmo. I was just wondering what your opinions are on them two devices.
Febsy, what are they, first of all?
Do you know, can I have the spelling, because I'm not sure?
Oh, sure, yes. Yeah. So, from what I understand, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, Anki, A-N-K-I. And
yeah,
the Anki Cosmo, so C-O-Z-M-O. And I believe they're robots, Paul, are they?
The first one is a robot, and the second one is a kind of a Scalextric, where you use your iPads to control the cars and iPhones.
And what kind of stuff does the robot do, Paul? What are the features that are kind of attracting you to it?
It plays games with children, and it pulls faces, it gets angry if it loses the game, and... you know, stuff like that. It's meant to be a really good robot, I suppose.
Okay, and is your son quite into that kind of stuff anyway?
Yeah, well, me and me both. me and me boy are.
Sounds like it's a gift for both of you, Paul.
Yeah, probably, possibly.
Nice one. And explain the second one, the Anki Overdrive, a little bit more right. for us. What's that all about? So you sort of race around a track, do you?
You do, yeah. You use your iPads or your iPhone to control the cars and have battles, and you know you can put a car out of service 10 seconds by shooting at it and stuff like that. Yeah, it does look really good, but I don't really want to commit, you know, £400 to these toys.
Right, are they like £400 each, or would be the combined price?
That's combined.
Right, okay, cool. Febsy, what do you reckon then? Kind of robots
so,
and stuff.
So I'm seeing the robot for just a shade under 160. It's not a robot I've used. I'm looking at the reviews on it. They seem generally quite positive, about 4.5 stars out of 5. I mean, I'm just looking at it. I mean, it looks good. I think the thing about this is it's going to also depend on you know, how well it's supported. This is a learning robot, so it should get better with time. I think for the money, you know, toys are not cheap these days. £160 is not cheap, but it's not outrageous either. I think it just
depends. Where have you found that for £160?
Well, I can say it, John Lewis. Save £40, it says. Up to, let's have a look. Just looking. Yeah, it's John Lewis says £40 saving. So,
well, I'm about to rang in now anyway.
although I noticed that with many of the things that they do, they extend the warranty to 2 years, but they're not doing it on this device, because I think it's TVs go to 5 years and a lot of other electronics go from 1 to 2. So this one is not. So yeah, I'm looking at that. I think I'd be more confident with the robot than the scale electric type racing. Yeah, because first of all, the reviews I'm seeing for the Anki Overdrive are less good, but also this idea of, you know, integrating with iPads and so forth. For toys, often the integration, and I haven't tried this, so I have to be careful how I say this, but often with toys, the integration is not really very meaningful or useful. And so I would look at exactly what the smart device would give you and add it to this. And particularly for things like racing games, if it's being used as a controller, I personally would prefer a physical controller anyway. So I think it's something to look at in a bit more detail. But I would say the robot looks, to me, it looks like more fun. But then I go back to the days of the old Sony Aibo robots, the A-I-B-O robots that they used to make, little robot dogs. And by the way, Sony are coming back with a new Aibo robot dog after having been out of the market for about 10 plus years. So yeah, but much more expensive, but more high tech as well. You know, I wouldn't mind getting that robot to play with for a bit. So.
It does look pretty cool, Paul. I had a little look at it there as well. It looks like it might be quite a bit of fun.
I mean, the general advice I'd also give you, given that it's over £100, is if you buy it, try and buy it on a credit card. If you can't buy it on a credit card, buy it on a debit card, because sometimes you get similar rights on debit cards. But if you buy it on a credit card, it's over £100. You've got protection under the Consumer Credit Act, which means if there is a problem with the product or the delivery of the product and the retailer isn't playing ball, the credit card company is equally liable for the transaction. And what you can often do is make a claim against the credit card company, and then they just charge it back to the shop if they're not behaving themselves. The other thing is look at the returns policies as well. So if you buy... So this is interesting, because your consumer rights are not as good now as they used to be a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, it was sort of lost on a lot of people. It used to be that there was something called distance selling regulations. As long as you bought it at a distance, i.e. online, over the phone, mail order, you used to have 14 days to return it for any reason at all, including it didn't match your curtains. Yeah. And as long as you hadn't broken it, it was fine. You know, you were entitled to a refund. Now the law says that if you bought it at a distance, you have the right to return it, but it has to be in resaleable condition. And if it is not, if they can't sell it again as new, then they have the right to pay you back less, because they'll get less for it when they sell it on.
Yeah.
And that could be, you know, in the worst case, that could, well, not even the worst case, but that could be, you know, quarter or half of the value of the device. Now, different people are interpreting that differently, because some shops are saying, oh, as long as the device is pristine, that's fine. Other people are saying, once you've broken the seal on the box, it's no longer resaleable as new, and they'll have to, you know, sell it for at least 10% down or whatever. So that's where the policy of the shop or online retailer becomes important, because often their returns policies are more generous than the law gives you as a minimum standard. And I'm really upset, because, you know, this is a change that's happened to our consumer rights, and there's been almost nothing said about it. And in a sense, you know, the differences are quite subtle on the face of it, but the effect is that, you know, you don't get all your money back, even if you've got the device in pristine condition, because the cellophane seal's broken, you know. So just be aware of that. You know, some online retailers have got very good returns policies. Some of them do the bare minimum. And for for a purchase like this, I think it's worth reading their returns policy before buying it from a particular retailer. I mean, I'll say, you know, there are many with good policies, but Amazon, for example, have, I think, 30 days and you can return it, you know.
Yeah.
Almost no questions asked. I mean, if you start, I noticed one thing with Amazon. If a person returns too many things to Amazon, they can actually kick you off. if they think that you're just sort of hiring stuff effectively or for free and sending it all back. Because I actually know that there were some technology reviewers, instead of getting review items from the manufacturers, they were actually buying them and returning them, and you know, some of those people ran into trouble with Amazon because they said no. So but for one or two or three or four or five or ten returns, it's generally not a problem. So look for a retailer, certainly doesn't have to be Amazon, but look for one that's got a generous returns policy, and pay, as I say, with a credit card if you can.
There you go then, Paul.
You would suggest Cosmo, but not Overdrive. Inclusion.
Look, I'm how old's your child?
He's six.
Six. I think a six-year-old would be delighted with any of those. I would say that the Cosmo would, I didn't see the age range on it, but it just seems a bit more self-contained, and if that was a six-year-old me, or indeed me now, I'd rather look. You know, frankly, if you want to buy two and send one my way, I'm not going to say no. But I personally, I think the robots looks like a better device in the round. But I have to say, I haven't tried either of them.
There you go, Paul. Sounds like it's going to be a fun Christmas. Thanks for ringing, Paul. Yeah. Good to speak to you. Thanks very much for that. Paul in Liverpool there, looking at buying some robots for his son for Christmas. Very interesting. A few more minutes left with Fevzi then. A couple of calls to get through. First of all, Mitchell in Torrington. Hello, Mitchell.
How you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. Right, something with an old Kindle Fire you've got a bit of a problem with. Pass it on to us and we'll see what we can do.
Okay, great. Thank you. And have a happy holiday season, if I forget.
You too.
Yeah, I've got an old edition Kindle Fire, and when I turn it on, it goes into a loop, and it just says Kindle Fire, and it just keeps doing that. It won't go to the main page. I've read a couple of things, and I've tried it. I've drained the battery and recharged, and then I plugged it into a laptop and tried to get it going that way, but it doesn't seem to work, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Well, have you tried to do a hard reset on it?
I'm not that computer literate. I've tried what I've seen on the WikiLeaks. I guess maybe I should be using something else.
I think you mean Wikipedia, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Mitchell, with most of the Kindle Fires, you can do a hard reset by pressing down the power button and holding it for about 20 seconds until it starts to do a reset that way.
Okay. I think the reason I didn't do that is I read that it would take away all the information that I had on it.
I can't promise you this, but I think normally with the hard reset on the Kindle Fires, it will do a hard reset in terms of a full restart, but I don't think it takes you back to factory settings. But
okay,
that's probably worth a bit more research before going down there. Do you have things on it that are particularly valuable to you that aren't up in the cloud as well?
I'm a chef, and I've got some recipes and some other things on it.
Right. Okay. What format are they stored in, those documents? How did you create them?
I just copied them from websites.
Right. Okay.
And then, you know, I basically work around it and everything. I also have some photos on there that are from my family and things like that.
Yeah. No, I understand. Well, I mean, and this is not a comment to you, and it's not me being smart with you because I've been in this position, but it's probably just worth at this juncture reminding people to take regular backups of all their devices, anything that they have. You're right, the hard reset, I'm just looking up now, will take it back to factory settings. And that's, well, for the very old ones, that's first to fourth generation. Is it an HD or an HDX model?
I think it's just HD.
Yeah, so if it's first to fourth generations, it's saying it will take it back to factory settings and clear the data from the memory. So therein lies the problem. I think... See, the shame of it is you can't get to the Mayday button on there to get them to help. I would actually ring Amazon themselves. They have a particular team that deals with Kindle and Kindle Fire devices. I would, given the sensitivity of the data on there, I would seek their advice in seeing if there is a way to effectively do a soft reset that's going to get you what you need. Because if you do the hard reset, you're right, it does seem that at least in some models it will wipe all the data. See, with Kindles it's usually not a problem, because the way that most people use Kindles is to have their Amazon content, which is their ebooks or their audiobooks or so forth, which is also stored in the cloud. But in your case, you're using it a little bit more like a sort of general purpose computing device, and that's a problem. So you used to be able to give Amazon a call directly on their customer service people. Nowadays, that number doesn't work anymore. So what you do is you go through the Amazon website and you go through help and go through contact, and it will ask you to say, is it this, is it that? And you say, no, it's something else. And you get to the bottom, you enter your phone number, and they can ring you back instantly. So it's worth doing that. I don't think they're there in the UK at this time anyway. That would be the way I would go, just because it will give you the best chance of retaining your data. It may be that the data is not recoverable, in the sense of it may be that there's no way to reset it without doing that. And even when you do that, that's not guaranteed to solve the problem either, I'm afraid. It depends on what's causing it. It does seem to be a software problem. But you see, if you were to, try and reinstate the software completely, that could also wipe the data as well. So I think you should tread carefully and get advice from the manufacturer on what they would advise you to do.
I'm just curious, if I may, if I was to get another Kindle, is there a way of using my old number to get into it? Or is it just stored on that actual computer? Kindle?
So the data is stored on the device's own memory. So getting a new Kindle, I don't think, would help you access anything on the first device. But it's also worth getting Amazon to talk you through whether that data has been backed up to their servers at any stage, perhaps even without you realizing it's happened. It may be that there is an online backup of that as well, because with Kindles, they have things called Kindle Docs, Kindle Documents, that can be stored in the cloud as well. So just check that one point with them. But I don't think buying a new Kindle will help with the data recovery. The only other thing I would say, and I think this is probably not going to be cost effective, but there are companies that specialize in data retrieval from failed devices. Most part that's sort of desktop computers, but there are some that will do tablets as well. But unfortunately, those services are expensive. They start in the hundreds of pounds and go into the thousands. So it depends. If it's your sort of the manuscript you've been working on for 5 years and have no copies of, then it may be worth it. If it's photos of loved ones that you can't replace, that may be worth it. But some of these companies, they will do services where they don't charge you if they can't recover the data. But it's not a cheap option.
Mitchell, thank you so much. Thanks for calling in. Needs a little bit more investigation by the sound of it, that one. Let's try and get to John in Hampshire before 3:30. Good morning, John.
Hello. My question is, so far I've been using my employer's computer and use Microsoft software. Yep. I'm thinking of buying my own computer, not necessarily before Christmas, it could be January, February. I don't play computer games. I only want a basic computer to do Word files, Excel, email, PowerPoint, and handle some photos I've taken on the digital camera.
Yep.
So I want to buy from a local shop so I get after-sale support rather than buying online. The shop probably only sells certain computer brands. So what questions should I ask from the shop in order to get a computer that's suitable for my needs? I mean, presumably a memory of about 1 gig would be enough for my basic needs.
All right, John. So this is a good question. I'm not wishing to speak against local shops because, they have their place, but as we sort of alluded to earlier in the program, quite often by buying online, you get better rights of return and sometimes better support than retailers in the high street as well. Some retailers in the high street are good, but many are not, in the sense that they, and I don't want to be too sweeping, but there are some very big chains out there that give some very poor advice to shoppers that don't know what they want. You know, they can sell you whatever you ask for, but helping you choose it is not great. And also the support that you get from them, they often make money by trying to sell you, you know, extended warranties and so forth that aren't always cost effective. So I would ask you to, first of all, consider again whether the local shop is necessarily the best bet, and whether it will give you the after sales support that you hope for. It may not, so just be aware of that. In terms of I would try and give you a specification. Are we talking about a laptop or a desktop computer, John?
Actually, possibly both, but starting off with just a laptop.
Okay, so with a laptop, in terms of the basic specifications, it should have, if we were talking about an Intel processor, it should have as a minimum an Intel Core i3.
And sorry, say that again. A minimum of what?
What's called an Intel Core i3. So this is to do with the power of the processor. If you can afford an i5 series processor, that will be better. In terms of the amount of memory, John, I would say a minimum of 4 gigabytes of RAM, because Windows really needs that to work well these days. And if it's expandable beyond 4 gigabytes, so much the better. Even if you buy it with 4 gigabytes, expandability is useful. I would look for, is cost a major consideration?
No, it isn't. No.
Okay, so I would get what's called a solid state drive built into it. So instead of having a hard drive with moving parts in it, I would get a solid state drive with a capacity of at least 256 gigabytes of storage on it. That will give you a computer that starts up quickly and works quickly. All right. So, and that, the reason why that's important is, even though a lesser computer will work well today, it will slow down over the life of the machine, because the software over time will become more demanding. And therefore, it's better value for money and a much better user experience to get the SSD. You're probably talking about a Windows machine, so you'll have on a new machine Windows 10. Then, in terms of a laptop, you need to consider the screen size and the overall bulk and weight of the unit. The bigger the screen, the easier it is to see what's going on the screen, and that's good if you're not going to move it around very much. But if portability is important to you, then a smaller screen and therefore a lighter laptop can be better. So a bigger computer would have a 15 or 15.6 inch screen. A smaller one would have 13 or 13.3. I wouldn't go smaller than 13.3 unless I was going to be plugging it into an external screen when I'm at my desk. So those are the specifications I think you should look for. If you stick to those sort of specs, you'll get a machine that will do what you need. By all means, you know, come back to me if you've got a particular model in mind.
Fevzy, thank you. John, thank you so much for ringing in as well. Appreciate that. And of course, anybody who, we've had a load of texts actually that we've not been able to get to, so anybody who's looking for an answer to their question can tweet Fevzy directly at Gadget Detective. Anytime, I imagine, Fevzy.
Yeah, I'll do my best. So if you haven't got your question through, at Gadget Detective on Twitter, ask the question. I'll do my best to help you there.
Great. Fevzy, thank you so much. Thanks.
Pleasure.
For your time.
Merry Christmas.
Really, yeah, and to you. Thank you. really good to speak to you. And thanks for giving us so much of your time this morning. That's Fevzy Turkalp, the Gadget Detective, who'll be back in the new year, I imagine, with more advice and help and solutions to all your problems and questions about gadgets and technology.
BBC Five Live.